Okay. The show moves on. We're starting now Megillat Esther. And Megillat Esther, the shir is dedicated in memory of Susanna Goldstein by Zev and Moshe Goldstein and families. So, should be a Liat Neshama. So I want to talk about Megillat Esther. Just a little bit of background about the Sefer, now that we're wrapping up the Megillas here. Megillat Esther happened during the Persian period. You have your bookmark, katanach.com. Bookmarks of the Jews are in exile after the First Temple. Mordechai is described as one of the people that was exiled from Israel in the Galut of Yechoniah HaMelech. And so this is the time period that we're in. The Jews are living in a foreign country, and as we will see, a potentially hostile environment. And that's where we find ourselves in the background in Megillat Esther. I'm assuming a little bit of familiarity relative to the other books in Tanakh, where you might be like, what is that? What, I've never heard of this before. The Megillah is something that is a little bit more at the fore of our consciousness. So I'm assuming a little bit of familiarity. We're going to talk about it a little bit of a higher structural level. So we know the story of the Megillah. It's actually interesting if you try and play it out. We know the story of the Megillah. There's Ahasuerus. He's the king. We don't know if he's a mastermind or some sort of affable guy. And there's a queen who's part of the story, a Jewish queen, Queen Esther. Haman is an evil enemy of the Jews. He arises. He hatches a plan to destroy all of the Jews in Persia. And Mordechai and Esther get together and they intercede at the last moment and they're able to stop the decree and everyone's really happy, as opposed to the conclusions of Eicha and Kohelet. There's a big party and we all have big smiles and we're cheerful. That's the story of the Megillah. The question that we can ask here is a question which, you know, is similar in certain ways to what we talked about in Shir HaShirim, and that is, if you read the story at face value, it's totally secular. There's no mention of God's name. There's no mention of anything. We read the story, and you can come to the conclusion that this is just a secular text. And in fact, there are academic scholars, I quoted some of them for you here in source number one, who just have take exactly this approach to Megillat Esther. This is from a shir from Professor Yonatan Grossman. A lot of the ideas, many of the ideas we're going to look at, come from him. So he notes, some scholars have argued that this text should be regarded as a satire meant to entertain the reader, intended solely for his pleasure. That's one potential reading. Or, there's no educational, moral, spiritual message behind the story, according to this view. Its purpose is merely to entertain and to arouse gaiety. Maybe it's because if you're flipping through Tanakh and you're really sad at this point, then you can get a laugh, and that's great. Others have maintained that the story is a secular one, a narrative in which God plays no role. Thus, for example, to Cornel, Esther reflects purely secular history, whose theme is the satisfaction of earthly desires and inclinations. An even more extreme formulation concerning Esther is proposed by Anderson. I'm not exactly sure who all these people are, but a witness to the fact that Israel in pride either made nationalism a religion in complete indifference to God, or presumptuously identified God's historical purpose with the preservation and glorification of the Jewish people. So, if you read these things, again, it's even worse than Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, you're wondering, why is there a love story in the middle of Tanakh? Esther, if you're going to read it like Anderson, like these scholars, then you're wondering, why is there a story in Tanakh which shows that Jews don't care about God? That's not a good thing to put into the Bible. That's obviously not good. So if I would ask you, what is your response to this claim? It doesn't say anything about God in the story of Esther. What is your response? What will you say?
Yeah. God's there, but he's hidden. You have to
go look. Oh, so God's there, but he's hidden, right? Was that what you were going to say? Something like that?
Also, that to accuse the Jews of de-godifying the world is kind of backward, because in Jewish tradition, we've taken this story and we say, like, a tefillah about how God was involved, and just we have God put God into it. So to say that we took it out and now we're putting it back in seems a little...
Right, okay. So yeah, you're going to have to say, clearly we don't think, you know, the religious, the traditional approach here is not to say, this is really a story about how the Jews forgot about God. Obviously not. The question that I want to deal with tonight is, can we prove that? In other words, let's say you say this, a secular scholar comes and says, you know what, I read Esther, it doesn't say anything about God in Esther, it's really just, it's like Shakespeare, it's like a comedy, and everything ends well, and nobody gets married, but whatever, but maybe someone got married in the background somewhere, and so it's really nice. And that's really what's going on. So what? And you want to respond as a religious person? No, this is really about God. It's really God's hand acting in history. Can you actually prove that? Is that borne out by the text at all, or is that just a claim that we make in terms of the way that we read Esther? And this is what I want to look at tonight in terms of studying the text of Megillat Esther. And what we're going to see is that in fact the author of the Megillah is making explicit claims about the meaning of the story. It's not the story is not just being presented as is. If we look carefully at the structure of the story, we're going to discover that the author is actually making a comment. It's a commentary on the story as well. This requires a little bit of a discussion about the notion of hidden meaning or hidden ideas that are inside the text, in the text of Tanakh. And this also comes from Professor Grossman. There are many times when the Tanakh uses, you know, the Tanakh is a piece of literature, and it uses literary devices. It uses, we saw it, most blatantly, we saw it before in Shir Shirim. The whole thing is an allegory. And I looked up the definitions of analogy, and I was totally wrong in my use of the word analogy, and it's really an allegory. So I apologize for that. I appreciate the correction. So in the interim, yes. Yeah. There are times when Shir Shirim, where the whole thing is a giant allegory, and you're not even told that it's supposed to be read one way or another. You're supposed to understand that this is all imagery, it's all symbolism, it's all talking about something else. There are other ways that the Tanakh as literature presents itself, and there's sort of pluses and minuses to using this kind of methodology. One of the minuses is that if you're too good with it, and it's too good of an allegory, or it's too hidden, then people will not even understand that there's anything going on, and they're going to read it like these secular scholars that read it in a totally irreligious way. But part of the value of having these kind of hidden meanings inside might be to make the reader read carefully. You know, the reader is sort of engaged with the text by trying to uncover what's going on, what sort of hidden things are in there, what kind of parallels are being drawn, what kind of references are being made. And as we will see in our case with Esther, it can also be used as a commentary. We're going to see here copious use in Esther of parallels. There's going to be language parallels, direct parallels in the words that are used in the text. And at the end, we're going to see a structural parallel, a huge structural parallel comprising the entire story of the Megillah, where we see that things were ordered very clearly in a certain way. And in that way, what we can say is that the author is presenting a story, the story of Shushan, the story of Mordechai and Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus, etc. But the way that the story is presented is also giving us a second layer of meaning, where the author is actually commenting on the story through the presentation of the story. So that's what I want to look at in terms of Esther. Okay, so what kind of parallels do we find? So we're going to look at, as we mentioned, two kinds. The first kind that we're going to look at is language parallels. And here there's very strong language parallel. You can't hide from it. It's this first whole table, which parallels the language that's used in the Megillah to describe Haman's plan and his buildup of his plan to destroy the Jews in Perek Gimel. And then subsequently in Perek Chet, to describe the language, describe the story of the undoing of that plan. And the language is exactly the same. We use the same words, the same phrases over and over again. So let's look at some of these examples. Number one, the first line here, request to destroy and save the nation. Vayomer Haman lemelech Achashverosh, im al hamelech tov yikatev labdam, if it's pleasing to the king, let's write an edict to destroy all the Jews. And then in Perek Chet, Vatomar, this is Esther, Imal HaMelech Tov, Yikatev Lahashivet HaSfarim Asher Katav LaBeit HaTeyudim. Same language, if it pleases the king here, if it pleases the king there. Fine. Second, giving the ring, it's an imagery. Vayasar Melech HaTavatom Al Yado Vayitna LaHaman. The Achashverosh gives his ring to Haman, and you see the same thing happen in reverse later. Vayasar HaMelech HaTavatom Asher Hevir MeHaman Vayitna LaMordechai. He takes his ring and gives it to Mordechai. Same thing, again, Third example, Vayomer Hamalach Laman Hakesef Netun Lecha Va'am Lasot B'Ketov Be'Necha, permission to do as you see fit. Same thing again. The king tells Mordechai and Esther, V'Atem Kitvu Al Yehudim Ketov Be'Nechem B'Shem Hamalach V'Chitmu B'Tabat Hamalach. You have the right to do it as you see fit. Same description of the Sfarim going out, writing and signing with the king's seal. Vayikru sofrei ha-melech, vayikatev kechol asher tziva ha-man al achashtar panei ha-melech. He sends out these messages to all the various levels of government, the satraps and the governors and the sarim, the officials, each individual place, etc. And you see the exact same language being used again to undo the edict later. Again, I mean, we don't have to read everything inside. It starts to get a little bit ridiculous. But you can see here that the same language is being used again and again and again and again to build up the story of Haman destroying the Jews and the undoing of the story of Haman destroying the Jews. If you look at the last column, the last line on the first page, you see the flip, the direct flip of the way that the city of Shushan is dealing with the situation. Vayir Shushan Navo was perplexed, confused, and Mordechai is tearing his clothing and being and mourning. And on the other side, Mordechai yatsa b'levush malchut. At the end, Mordechai comes out with wearing king's clothes. He's wearing royal garments. And vayir Shushan tzahala v'samecha. The city is joyous and happy. V'b'chol medina v'na, b'chol me'ir v'ir. Makom asher devar melech v'dato magia simcha v'sason le'yehudim. Where there was upset, where there was pain, where there was confusion, now there is joy and happiness for the Jews. Okay, and there's a couple extra ones which are added on here which don't exactly fit into this Haman build-up plan and the downfall of Haman plan, but they are clear language parallels. One of them is the story about deciding to hang Mordechai on the tree. So Haman is consulting with his family, with Zeresh, his wife, and his wife tells him, "V'tomar lo Zeresh ishto v'chol ohavav yasu etz gavoa chamishim amah u'beboker emor lamelech v'yitlu et Mordechai alav." Let's make a tree. We'll make a tree which is 50 amas high, and they'll hang Mordechai on it. And then there's the undoing on the other side. Vayomer chavona gam hine ha'etz asher asa Haman leMordechai asher diber tov al hamelech. Omed beit Haman gavoa chamishim amah v'yomer hamelech taluhu alav. So the tree that he set up was the tree which was used for his undoing. And finally, you have the center story, which we're going to come back to, which is the story of Haman coming in the middle of the night. And Achashverosh says, "I want to honor someone. What should we do?" And Haman thinks that it's him, obviously, because who else would it be? And he says, "Yeah, you should dress him up in the king of the clothes and put him on the king's horse and so on, and take him through the streets." And in the end, the opposite ends up happening, obviously, and Haman is the one that has to take Mordechai through the streets in that exact same situation. So we find here it's clear that the author of the Megillah is making these language parallels. It's not an accident. Sometimes it's easy to miss it if you're reading the Megillah and, you know, straight. You don't notice. Some of these things do come up. You do, at least in my case, you do notice them. And some of the things you don't notice. But it's clear that this is a commentary. This is not just a presentation of the story. It's a commentary on the story. And I will give you a sort of an example, like an anecdotal example. Imagine I told you the following two stories. Story number one. On June 5th, 1967, in a feat of daring, the IDF bombed the Egyptian planes while they were still, the Egyptian Air Force, while they were still on the ground and destroyed them. Version 1 of the story. Version 2 of the story. On June 5th, 1967, the IDF sent a group of planes to destroy the Egyptian Air Force. In preparation for war with Israel, the Egyptians generally sent sorties of fighter jets over the Mediterranean, but it happens to be that the night before, June 5th, some of the officers were out drinking, and they woke up a little bit late, and they came late, and they launched the sortie late, so they missed the Egyptian planes. And the Egyptians usually were equipped with really good anti-aircraft guns, but it happens to be that when the IDF planes were flying over the Mediterranean, the Egyptian high command was in a plane, and they didn't want any of the anti-aircraft guns to fire because then they'll shoot down all their generals, and so they didn't let anyone fire without explicit command from the guy that was on the plane that they couldn't hear from anyway because he was on the plane. So the IDF planes managed to get through, and they bombed all the Egyptian planes which were on the ground. I think those are all true facts, actually. But you see that if you tell the story in those two different ways, it's clear that I'm getting at something. The first way, I'm just telling you a fact. It's a tremendous fact. The IDF managed to bomb the Egyptian planes on the ground. The second way, I'm trying to tell you something. You know, the IDF planes are coming. And it happened to be that this worked out, and this worked out, and this worked out, and this worked out. Are you getting the message yet? All of these things happened to work out perfectly, and it managed to go the right way. So the author of the Megillah is clearly making this kind of argument with these parallels. Don't be fooled and think that this is just a random story where, you know, some things happened and then later some other things happened and the Jews managed to make it out and it was okay. It's not a coincidence that Haman tried to do A and exactly the opposite of A happened. And Haman tried to do B and then exactly the opposite of B happened. This is a commentary that the author of the Megillah is making in terms of the story. And it's message number one of things that we can learn from the Megillah is that the author is making a comment about the story and saying there's clearly something else going on. You have to infer what that else is. We answer to a higher authority. So that's point number one, parallel number one, the commentary that the author of the Megillah is making. The second, yeah.
The difference is what you told with aircraft.
Yeah.
Different newsreaders reported different stories.
Okay.
And the Megillah is written by one person, so you don't know which is like fake news or not.
Well, that's fine. I don't want to get involved in fake news. I'm scared of fake news. But real news or news that's in between.
All the news stories have different things.
Right, that could be true. I'm not, the factuality of the story about the IDF planes is not the point. The point is if I present the story one way or I present the story the other way, it's clear that I'm trying to make some kind of argument. If the argument is wrong, I don't know if it's wrong in that case. But,
that one was really an analogy.
What?
I said that one was really an analogy.
Okay, there we go. So, it's good. I need to go back to high school English and get all these terms straight. So fine. So but that's my point. My point is, if you present the story in a certain way, and that's clearly what's going on here, this happened and the opposite happened. This happened and the opposite happened. This happened and the exact opposite happened. The point is to relay, to express some kind of message. Okay, what is the other structure? What is the other parallel structure we have? Inside the Megillah, there's a giant chiastic structure. Does anyone know what a chiastic structure is?
I just looked it up.
Okay, there we go. It's on the street. It's on the sheet. Chiastic structure. The easiest way to explain the chiastic structure is to look at the chiastic structure. It's like a pyramid. The idea is that you have one point at the beginning of a story and a parallel idea at the end of the story. And then the second point in the story parallels the second last, and the third last, etc. Until you reach the top of the pyramid. And the idea here is, this is a literary device which is meant to focus your attention to whatever is in the middle of the pyramid. That's the idea. We have all of these things that are the same, and it's supposed to focus your attention at whatever is going on in the middle. So this is interesting. This is also from Professor Grossman, and he notes that you can construe the entire Megillat Esther as a giant chiastic structure. It starts with the discussion of Ahasuerus' kingdom, and it ends with the discussion of Ahasuerus' kingdom. It starts with two feasts, right? Ahasuerus produces two feasts. It ends with two feasts. At the beginning, they're for all the people, all of the subjects of Ahasuerus. At the end, they're for the Jews. But in the first one also, there was one for all the people in Shushan and one for everyone in the kingdom. And the second case also, there was one feast of the Jews for all the Jews that were living wherever they were living in Persia, and another one specifically for the Jews in Shushan. Esther appears before the king and is chosen. Esther comes before the king to request additional help at the end of the Megillah. There's some sort of second discussion between Esther and the king. It's not exactly clear what that's about, but it becomes very clear if we're looking at it in terms of this chiastic structure. There's a description of Haman's stature in D, and there's a description of the stature of the Jews and Mordechai. There's the casting of the lot. We pick the 13th of Adar. And then there's the war on the 13th of Adar, which instead of having the Jews be killed, the Jews are the ones who are able to succeed against their enemies. F, there's giving the ring to Haman. Haman's letters, Mordechai rending his clothes, fasting, basically all the language stuff that we looked at in the first section, where there were direct linguistic parallels. And there's F prime, the second F, where we give the ring to Mordechai. Mordechai sends out letters. Mordechai gets dressed up in fancy clothes instead of tearing curtain is closed. The Jews are excited. There's Esther's first meal, Esther's second meal, Haman's consultation with his family, his wife, where they tell him, you should go hang Mordechai. Haman's consultation with his associates again, his wife and his friends, where they say, oh, this is always very confusing, but if you look at it in this context, it makes sense. They come to Zeresh, he comes to Zeresh, and Zeresh says, oh, you should hang him on a tree. No problem, Mordechai's okay. You can get rid of him, just hang him on a tree. And then a short while later, she says, oh, he's a Jew? Well, if he's a Jew, you're toast. That's what happens. And I always wondered, there was like, something was lost in the conversation there. How exactly does that work? But if you're looking at it in this structure, it makes sense. There's two parallel discussions. And in the middle, what's in the middle? The story, Balayla hu nadadash natamelech, that night the king couldn't sleep, Achashverosh couldn't sleep, and we have the story of Haman coming. Achashverosh says, I want to honor somebody, and Haman thinks it's him, we mentioned before, and the situation ends up getting flipped around, and Mordechai is the one who is honored instead of Haman. So we see that there's this chiastic structure, it's pointing to this middle story. And again, this is a clear attempt, a clear their attempt of the author of the Megillah to make a commentary on the story. I'm not just telling you historical events, I structured it so that you should, I'm trying to explain that this scene, the scene of Mordechai, or Haman rather, in Achashverosh, and the scene of Mordechai being pulled through the city on the horse, is the pivotal point. It's the key to the whole story. So in what sense is it the key to the whole story?
On your diagram, it's clear that the turning point is Nadadah-Amelech.
Right, okay, the kernel is the king couldn't sleep, yeah. And part of that discussion has to be, you're reading that part of the story and you're wondering what Hamelech are we talking about. Suddenly the name Achashverosh recedes and we hear Hamelech, 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 Hamelech. And which Hamelech? Are we talking about the king Achashverosh Hamelech? Are we talking about God Hamelech, who's acting in the background? So yes. But this scene where the things flip around, so part of the story is, again, what we saw, part of the message seems to be what we saw before, that things can turn around, and things turned around and became exactly the opposite of what they had been originally. Part of the story, I think, and this relates to the title, was that you have Haman. Haman's coming to see the king, and Haman is he's a passionate person. He's full of his own worldview. His worldview has been confirmed by his placement in the king's palace. It's been confirmed by his family. It's been confirmed by his wife. He made these plans to get rid of the Jews. However you're going to explain his philosophical ideas, why does he want to get rid of the Jews per se, he made a plan, and he wanted to pay off the king, and he sent out the letters, and everything was going great. He set up the tree to hang Mordechai, and all of a sudden, we get the phrase, "Kacha yaseh la'ish asher hamelech chafetz bikaro." This is what happens to a person who the king, not the king Achashverosh, the king God, desires to honor. It doesn't matter that Haman set up this whole plan and he believed it and he was passionate about it and he followed it and he really thought he was the one that was deserving of honor more than anybody else. If God doesn't want you to succeed, it doesn't matter what kind of situation you set up, it's going to fall apart. You're not going to be successful. There's a little bit of a tragic irony there. It's not just that God intervened to save the Jews. It's also teaching us an important lesson. What's critical in terms of the efforts that you put in your life is not only, I mean, it's important to try hard, but you can try as much as you want, and sometimes, very often, if God doesn't want whatever you're planning to happen, it's simply not going to happen, and it's going to fall apart to pieces in a moment. And so this is the second comment, I think, which is being made here by the author of the Megillah. So just to recap what we've done here, we talked about the text of the Megillah. It seems to present itself at face value as simply a story, a secular story about Jews and politics and intrigue in Persia. And some people read it that way. And if we're going to make the argument that that's not true, that really the Megillah is presenting us with something else, if we look carefully at the text, we see that the author of the Megillah wasn't just presenting a narrative, a story about what happened in Persia, but the way that the text is organized, the hidden ideas, the literary devices which are being used, specifically we have the linguistic parallel and this chiastic structure, are clearly comments that the author of the Megillah is making to make us interpret, to try and show us what the interpretation of the story ought to be. And one comment is that everything Haman tried to do was flipped on its head, it was turned sideways, God really was involved. It can't be that all of these things turned out exactly the opposite of the way that they were intended without God's involvement. And secondly, interestingly, something which is not necessarily really related to the Megillah, but all of Mordechai, all of Haman's efforts rather, and his sincere commitment to his cause, also got flipped on its head, because it doesn't matter how much effort you put in, if God is not on your side or you're not on God's side, it's simply not going to work. So this is a way of looking at Megillah Esther.